The U.S. expresses concern about signs that Iran and Russia are upgrading military ties. The UN Nuclear Agency reports more defiance by Iran of demands for transparency in its nuclear program. A researcher tells us how the IAEA's governing board may react.
I would not expect very much because they're not going to want to provoke Iran and get reactions from Iran that then can somehow worsen the situation right now in the Middle East.
Plus, a VOA Persian reporter shares witness accounts of Iran's increasing harassment of women refusing to wear the mandatory hijab. And an Iranian-American activist talks about how she helped to build a coalition of advocates for tougher U.S. sanctions on Iran's Islamist rulers.
That's kind of what makes it so special and so beautiful, is that we don't have political backgrounds. We come from all walks of life.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The White House says it appears that Iran is poised to boost its military support for Russia's war against Ukraine. Iran already has provided drones to Russia, which has used them to attack Ukrainian infrastructure since last year. Here's what U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby told reporters in a virtual briefing on Tuesday.
Iran may be preparing to go a step further in its support for Russia. In September, Iran hosted Defense Minister Shoigu and showcased its Ababil close-range ballistic missile, as well as the Fatah 110 short-range ballistic missile system. We are therefore concerned that Iran is considering providing Russia with ballistic missiles now for use in Ukraine.
Kirby said that in return, Moscow has offered Tehran unprecedented defense cooperation, including on missiles, electronics, and air defense. As an example, he asserted that Russia is directing the Wagner mercenary group to prepare to provide air defense capabilities either to Iran or its Lebanese proxy Hezbollah.
This burgeoning defense relationship is not good for the people of Ukraine, and frankly, it's not good for the Middle East region. So again, we're going to monitor this closely, and we'll keep taking appropriate actions as required.
There were no immediate responses from either Iran or Russia to Kirby's assertions about their growing military cooperation. Another aspect of that cooperation is Russia's apparent development of a facility for producing Iranian-designed attack drones. The White House asserted in June that the facility is in Russia's Alabuga Special Economic Zone. Moscow has said it relies on its own resources in using drones to attack Ukraine. Iran has acknowledged supplying drones to Russia before the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. The Washington-based Institute for Science and International Security has been studying documents apparently leaked from Alabuga several months ago. I spoke to the Institute's president, David Albright, on Monday about his latest work on Alabuga. I also asked him about the International Atomic Energy Agency's new reports on Iran's nuclear program, prepared for this week's meeting of its governing board. One report looks at Iran's compliance with a 2015 nuclear deal to curb its uranium enrichment. Western powers say that process could be diverted to make nuclear weapons, while Iran insists the program is peaceful. The other report examines Iran's compliance with nuclear non-proliferation treaties or safeguards. Here's what Albright had to say on the IAEA reports.
Well, the safeguards report is the more troubling in the sense that the IAEA is saying we're finding that Iran is not cooperating. They're saying that we're not going to answer these questions. Don't expect us to. And there's very little hope in this report that Iran is going to address the IAEA concerns that get to this issue. Does it have undeclared nuclear material or activities? And since it is a report to its members and its board of governors, it's saying there's not much more we can do. If Iran refuses to cooperate, the board of governors needs to take action. Now, the other report just charts Iran's buildup of enriched uranium, gas centrifuges, how much 60% enriched uranium it has. And Iran has moved slower on its buildup of enriched uranium, particularly 60%, but it's moving forward. It has more enriched uranium than it had in the last report 3 months ago. And therefore, if you measure this by what we call breakout, how long does it take Iran to get enough weapon-grade uranium for a nuclear weapon, then it's able to produce more quantities of weapon-grade uranium for a nuclear weapon. So it's not necessarily able to do it faster, but it can make more. So the nuclear program is clearly advancing.
What do you expect the IAEA governing board will do when it meets later this week?
I think with this war in Gaza and a lot of effort to try to keep Iran and Hezbollah from entering the war, I would not expect very much, because they're not going to want to provoke Iran and get reactions from Iran that then can somehow worsen the situation right now in the Middle East. Now, I think in the past couple of years, the European governments and the United States have been pretty timid about confronting Iran over these nuclear violations and these issues raised by the IAEA. But you have an unusual situation here where, in essence, in two successive reports on the safeguards issues, the Director General, Grossi, has said, I'm sort of at my wit's end. They're just not cooperating. They're not answering. I can't force them to. In essence, saying the Board of Governors really needs to address this and make a decision about what to do. I mean, should the IAEA, in a sense, keep throwing itself against a brick wall and getting the same answers from Iran? Should the Board of Governors issue a very strong condemnation of Iran's behavior and lack of cooperation? It's already put Iran on warning about that. And should the issue be referred to the UN Security Council for consideration? And that by itself doesn't necessarily mean anything, given China and Russia's positions on things and their split with the United States and Britain and France on the Security Council. But it would clearly say that probably the next step would be the snapping back of the sanctions under the provisions of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and that would have much more impact.
Well, moving on to another topic that we discussed on this show in September, which is Russia's production of attack drones designed by Iran at this drone production facility called Alabuga inside Russia. Now, your institute noted last week that the United States and its allies have not sanctioned that Alabuga facility or its associated companies. Why do you think that is?
I don't know the answer fully. I'm told, and I've been told this for several months, the sanctions on Alabuga are in the pipeline. This, for example, would be Treasury Department sanctions. But there's some hurdle to overcome. I've been assessing Alabuga documents, internal documents, pretty intensely for a couple months, and kind of looked up when I was done and still saw that there were no sanctions, and have raised it. And I'm not getting very satisfactory answers. But I think my view is that there should be more pressure to finish the application or whatever it's called inside the U.S. government, so that Treasury and then state issue sanctions on Alabuga, that it's long overdue.
Well, another step that you have been calling for at the Institute is for the West to essentially try to cut off Alabuga's access to electronic components that are needed to produce these Iranian-designed attack drones. And you also mentioned in our last conversation that some governments have been seeking your guidance in how to do that. Can you share anything more on that front?
Well, that side of it is going much better. If you're a Netherlands or United States company, there's real interest in not having your particular electronics equipment or servo motor show up in a drone that is shot down over Ukraine. And Ukraine diligently picks apart these things and identifies the parts and then publicizes it. And there's much more interest in the governments. The information gained from these internal documents in Alabuga are welcome among governments in order to better plot out strategies to disrupt the supply chain for Alabuga. And you know, what materials to cover, what are the critical components, you know, let's say made by Texas Instrument. They could then focus on that one much more intensely than some of the others that aren't so important. And perhaps what they could do is simply limit the distribution of that part So I think on the supply chain, things are moving forward, and the information in the documents is welcome, certainly by every government I've ever talked to. I mean, obviously, I'm not talking to Russia or Iran, but the governments overall are interested in finding better ways to disrupt the supply, because the reality is well over half of the electronic parts in one of these Shahed 136 drones are made in America.
Would you be able to name some of the governments that are in touch with you about trying to curtail Alabuga's access to these components?
Well, I can say European. I mean, I'm hesitant to just name governments, but certainly, you know, several European governments, some Asian governments, governments that have companies in them whose components are found in the Shahed 136 drones are on the lists of equipment prepared by Alabuga based on Iranian lists, you know, Switzerland, Netherlands. I mean, they're certainly interested in what we have to offer. So those would be two. And basically any country that is in the supply chain is interested and we've tried to contact. And so I think we find that the reception is good. Overall, the reception in the United States has been extremely good among multiple parts of the government.
Well, David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, joining us on the line from Münster, Germany. Good to speak with you again on Flashpoint Iran.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iranian authorities appear to be increasing pressure on women in major cities to wear the mandatory hijab. VOA's Persian service reported last week that witnesses in Tehran and Isfahan saw security forces lurking in traffic next to bus stops and inside metro rail stations to try to catch women not wearing the hijab. The accounts of harassment come weeks after the death of Armita Garavand, a 17-year-old Iranian whom rights groups said was assaulted on the Tehran metro by morality police for defying the hijab law. Iranian authorities said she fell into a coma due to a loss of blood pressure. Garavand died in a hospital on October 28th. VOA Persian's Saghi Lagai wrote the story about the latest harassment cases. I asked her how she communicated with witnesses in Iran, where authorities prosecute people for sharing information with Western media.
You're right, Michael. It is not easy in general, but I used to be a journalist inside Iran for many years, and I'm still in touch with many activists from different fields, different cities and generations. We trust each other, and they want to talk to me to get their identity on now.
To keep their identity anonymous.
Exactly that.
Now, what were the most interesting stories that your contacts shared with you about the harassment that's going on against women who are not wearing the mandatory hijab?
To be honest, each of the stories was disturbing to me. I can't say which one is more sad, not feeling safe when you want to go home or and having concerns of being targeted by the Islamic Republic forces when using the metro or facing consequences for not wearing a hijab in public. Just see what happened to Armita Garavand a few weeks ago. The teenage girl was beaten by Islamic Republic forces and then died because she did not wear hijab. But on the other hand, what's remarkable is that many women resist wearing hijab even when they got arrested.
Now, when you think about the stories of harassment that people shared with you, as a journalist, I guess you have to be thinking, how can I verify? How can I try to get a confirmation or another source who has a similar kind of story to what you heard? So how are you able to try to verify the accounts of harassment that you received?
Well, eyewitnesses from different cities share similar experiences. And there are tens of social media posts with photos and videos confirm their stories. And the previous information from these sources who I talked to was reliable and accurate. So kind of I trust them.
So in your article for the VOA Persian website, you shared the accounts from the witnesses about how the security forces are using different ways to kind of harass and pressure women into wearing the hijab on the streets, when they use public transportation. So how are women and girls in Iran who don't like the mandatory hijab, how are they dealing with these types of harassment?
It's really hard to say. Whether in Tehran, Isfahan, or other cities, people experience challenges. Like Roya Zakeri, for example, a young woman in Tabriz, she shouted against Khamenei after the forces confronted her because of hijab, and then she got arrested and was taken to a mental hospital instead of jail. It's tough for her and her family, obviously, but on the other hand, freedom-loving Iranians still persist.
How are they persisting? What are they doing to try to show their objection to the mandatory hijab and also try to avoid getting taken to a mental hospital, as was the case that you just described?
Some of these women have, for example, like a hijab with them in their bag or in their shoulders and put on their head when they are in danger. Or there are some pictures showing that some girls and young women are not wearing hijab next to Islamic Republic forces even.
What are your contacts in Iran saying about their expectations for the future? What do they think is going to happen and what are they going to do?
Well, they mentioned that in the last year, international support made the Islamic Republic retreat and Gasht-e-Irshad, which is so-called morality police, decreased in the streets. But when the support became less and decreased, then pressure increased. Witnesses say that the fight for freedom continues and global support can help to make a difference. They are hopeful, I think.
Well, on that hopeful note, Saghi Laghai, VOA Persian multimedia journalist on the line from here in Washington, D.C. Great to have you with us again on Flashpoint Iran.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Michael.
On last week's show, we heard from Sarah Raviani, an Iranian-American activist involved in a campaign to lobby the U.S. Congress for tougher laws sanctioning Iran's top officials. Raviani updated us on the progress of the Mahsa Act, named for an Iranian Kurdish woman, Mahsa Amini, who died in police custody last year after being arrested for allegedly not wearing her hijab strictly enough. The act was approved by the House of Representatives in September and is under consideration in the Senate. This week, Raviani tells us how she got involved in the campaign.
So it began for me just by posting on social media when the revolutionary uprising began in Iran. I started posting on Instagram because I felt a personal responsibility to speak up as a second-generation Iranian-American for the people back home in Iran. So I started raising awareness, and I wanted to do more. And it specifically legislatively took off for me when the executions began surging in Iran near the end of 2022. So that's when I decided to do more, and I wanted to make a practical difference for the people of Iran. So I started advocating for legislation and for speaking to lawmakers about the situation inside of Iran.
When it comes to legislation, had you had any experience with that before? I mean, how do you know what to do when it comes to laws?
I had personally very little experience. I was very politically aloof, as was the rest of our immigrant diaspora community. There's a level of trauma that was present that made us feel a little bit uncomfortable speaking with lawmakers. So this was something that was very foreign to me. It was very foreign to a lot of the other activists that were mobilizing to make their voices heard. And so we just started from the ground up, and we started working towards learning together. And that's kind of what makes it so special and so beautiful, is that we don't have political backgrounds. We come from all walks of life, and everyone just rallied together as a community to learn, to grow, and to mobilize.
Well, when it comes to the learning that you did together with these other activists, how did you go from posting about the situation in Iran on social media to actually meeting new people and, you know, getting together in person, in real life, as we say?
It took a lot of work, and it was a lot of word of mouth, but luckily we have technology and we utilize social media, specifically Twitter, to connect with activists from coast to coast nationwide. We started hosting weekly Twitter spaces to connect with one another and to build a community. And that was one of the most incredible aspects of this, is that we started with just, you know, a handful of people, and then amounted to close to 100 activists that were all making calls and all working together. And it was just through the use of social media and technology. And a lot of our activists are younger, so we have our phones in our hands all day long, and we used it to make a difference, which was something that's really, really incredible, in my opinion.
Well, you talked about how many of your fellow activists come from all walks of life. So how diverse would you say is this coalition of activists that you're a part of in terms of, you know, your ideological standpoints? And where would you fit yourself into that spectrum?
So I say we come from all walks of life, and I truly mean that. We have activists that are college-age students. We have activists that are mothers and fathers. We have activists that have no Iranian heritage whatsoever, that have put aside all of their ideological and political differences to work together to bring about change. And that's something that's really important to us as activists that are working on legislation, is a lot of times we don't really talk about our domestic political stances or where we fall on certain issues. And that's how we've been able to avoid a lot of arguments and bumps in the road, is by not discussing those things, because at the end of the day, we're advocating for human rights and for freedom and democracy inside of Iran. And we have activists that are on both sides of the political spectrum. We have activists that they're politically aloof, or once were politically aloof, and have decided to just work together to get this legislation passed.
Well, part of the working together has been actually traveling, and you've done some traveling yourself. So how have you been able to juggle the traveling that's involved in this activism with your everyday working life?
We had to make a lot of personal sacrifices, and that meant taking time off of work. That meant taking time away from our families to set aside time to go to Washington to speak with lawmakers in person. And that was something that many activists did, and we did it together. We did it on several different occasions, and I encourage everybody that's listening to do that, because I think that that's something a lot of Americans don't realize, that we have the right to make our voices heard to our elected officials. And it's truly special going and doing it in person in Washington, D.C. You're able to see the place where all of the action happens, and the travels, they've been very fun. They've been hard, but it's been a great experience. I had never been to Washington, D.C. prior to starting activism. So it was a very new experience for me, but we learned along the way and we did it together. And that's what made it so special.
Well, Sarah Raviani, Iranian American activist on the line from Dallas, Texas. Great to have you with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here to share our story. It's been such a pleasure working with activists across the nation to make our voices heard, and I'm incredibly honored to be here with you today.
That's all for this week's show. We have more episodes for you on Apple and Google Podcasts. Thanks for listening, and please join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.